A legal dream team joins the fight for local schools. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect, and I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, it's a trio of high-powered attorneys representing Duval County Public Schools in their sales tax push. We'll speak with these legal eagles in just a moment. You can join us. It's 549-2937. Then later in the hour, how to reform company culture. Easier said than done. It's a conversation with speaker and author Jim Knight. That's later. But first this morning, the Duval County School Board has lawyered up in its fight to get a sales tax referendum before local voters. The high-powered trio of attorneys Hank Cox, Audrey Moran, and Scott Cairns are representing the Duval Board. This, even though a city attorney told the school officials that they weren't even allowed to hire their own counsel. So, what is the next move in this fight? This morning, we will get some updates as we welcome all three attorneys to Studio 5. Hank Cox, Scott Cairns, and Audrey Moran all joining us in studio. Thanks so much for being here, everybody.
Good morning.
And here's our question to callers. Where would you vote on the sales tax referendum for Duval County Public Schools? What are your questions for the attorneys now representing the school board? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax or weigh in on Facebook. All right, Hank Cox, let's begin with you. It's my understanding you were the first attorney to come on board representing the school board. Why'd you decide to do this pro bono?
First, let me begin by thanking you for the opportunity to be here, and I think Scott and Audrey joined that. I'm a product of the public schools. All my children are products of the public school system in Duval County, and that gives you a certain loyalty to the process and to the system. I was approached by a number of people because of that asking if I'd consider getting involved when it appeared that the tax proposal was not making any headway in getting on the ballot. And I didn't know much about the law at the time, thought I'd look at it, but I wasn't going to do it alone. And as Scott Cairns, who's with us now, knows, we have teamed up with other lawyers on a number of issues, often pro bono, including representing the city of Jacksonville to help the mayor keep his pension fund proposal on the ballot. So that's one of the ironies of why we're sitting here. But be that as it may, first I talked to Scott. Scott is from the national firm of McGuire Woods. He is the main lawyer in the firm here, and his firm has national experience representing countless school boards, superintendents, and so forth. So he brought that, not only his personal talent, but the experience of that huge law firm. And I think that's especially beneficial. We also knew that Audrey was leaving Baptist in that career very, very soon. I talked to Audrey, and Audrey said she'd be excited to join us. And I will say, for a number of lawyers in town who've also volunteered to help, and we intend to take advantage of that assistance as we move along, it has been an interesting process, and where it heads, I don't know. And before I turn it over to Scott or Audrey, two qualifications here. Number one, we agreed, and we agreed with you, Melissa, that we would not discuss the legal merits of what may or may not take place if there is litigation. Our task from the school board was to identify whatever options might exist that would try or attempt to facilitate getting the proposal on the ballot. That is the only mission we have, is to get that proposal on the ballot and let the taxpayers decide about the safety and well-being of the students in those schools and the conditions that have become, especially in the northwest part of the city and elsewhere. So that's our mission. It's nothing else. And there have been a host of collateral. I don't want to get into how I would describe them, but that's not our concern.
Okay. So Scott Cairns, partner at McGuire Woods, as Hank said, your firm has national experience in these types of battles. What is the next move for your group of attorneys?
Well, as Hank says, we're still analyzing that, and we're not going to get into any particular strategy that we might have at this point. But I want to reiterate what Hank says. Our role is very narrow. Hank came to me, and this was before Mr. Gabriel had issued his formal opinion to look at the statute that's involved here, which is 212-055, that simply says that if the school board does a resolution seeking to have a sales surtax, that the city council shall put it on the ballot. The initial opinion that we saw, which was an informal opinion, said, to use the colloquial phrase, shall means may. And so we, before we did anything else, took a look at what we thought the law was and respectfully disagreed with that analysis. So before it was put in stone, we met with Mr. Gabriel to express our views. And at that meeting, he invited us to say, if we had any research on this issue, give it to him. And so we did. And that started our involvement, was providing him a memorandum of why we thought this was wrong. And of course, he ended up not following our analysis and issuing a formal opinion.
Right. And Audrey Moran, Mr. Gabriel also told the school board they would be responsible for any legal fees in hiring outside counsel. Essentially told the school board they weren't allowed to hire outside counsel. The school board went ahead and hired all of you, and you're waiving any legal fees. Why is this so important for you and the others to take on?
You know, Melissa, I became a lawyer because I hate bullies, you know, and the law allows you to provide a forum where the facts can be laid out in a dispassionate way, and a judge, a neutral arbiter, can make a decision about very important issues. We believe this issue is critical for the future of public education in Duval County. The school system is desperate for better infrastructure to house and educate our children in this community. And all that's being asked at this point is, let the voters vote. And the voters have been blocked from voting. We believe that was improper and illegal. And we want to get this issue to the voters as quickly as possible.
So it sounds as though you're crafting a legal argument to try to show that city officials have obstructed the referendum going before the voters. Is that correct? Is that fair to say?
When the resolution was withdrawn by city council, it effectively blocked the issue from going on the ballot. We believe this issue about a sales surtax for public schools must go to the ballot, that is something that the city council was required to do. And at this point, it looks like a judge will have to help us with that.
Let me ask you as a follow-up. Some city council members, in throwing up questions and concerns about the referendum, have alleged that the school board wasn't honest with them about their plan. They referred to a timeline repeatedly for school improvements, they said, suddenly appearing when they said that they weren't presented with that before. What's your response as attorneys for the board to that argument? Because I heard several city council members use that as a rationale for not voting for this referendum to go before the voters to shore up all of these aging school buildings in the county.
Well, one of the things that has led to the impasse where we are right now is the initial view that the word shall actually gives discretion to the city council to decide whether to put this on the ballot. We think that initial view is wrong, and that one of the things that Hank said is we as lawyers are not involved in the merits of whether the school referendum should be passed. It's simply whether it's put on the ballot. So all of those issues about what's wrong with the school plan, what's right with the school plan, that's really not our role here.
Your role is to get this before the voters. Let me ask you as well about some ancillary matters. Let's talk about Hurricane Dorian for a minute. That showed the importance of public schools being in good shape as they're used as hurricane evacuation shelters. How might that factor into your case? Because we saw that during the storm, the shelters were operative, the schools were used that way.
Yeah, I can't speak for Scott or Audrey, but Melissa, that to me implicates whether the voters approve it or not, whether that issue is one thing they'll consider in approving it, not whether legally it should be before the voters to approve. I mentioned earlier there are a number of collateral issues that have arisen through all this, some of which are pleasant, some of which I consider extremely unpleasant professionally. And I'm surprised at some of the behaviors.
Like what? What do you consider to be unpleasant?
I consider a letter from the general counsel to the school board members telling them that if they continue on the path they're headed, and if it costs money, for whatever reason, in the retention of lawyers, that it's coming out of their individual pockets. When you are telling the world that they are your client, they can't be our client, they're your client, why are you threatening them in the public arena with that. And then to follow that up with a letter to us telling us about all the different Florida bar rules that we're in jeopardy of violating if we continue on the path we're continuing. Well, I think Scott, Audrey would agree, professionally, that's unpleasant. That's not the way we practice law. And we're a little surprised because I've always considered Jason Gabriel a good friend. I like Jason Gabriel. I like John Phillips. And so you read the letter and say, who's writing these letters? It can't be Jason Gabriel and John Phillips writing these letters.
You don't think they wrote their own letters?
I don't. I'm not saying they didn't. Their names are on them, but it's just not the style and tone that we've come to expect from Jason or John.
Who do you think is behind that style and tone then?
I wouldn't even presume to predict because that's not part of the legal issues we're involved in. But the collateral issues, Melissa, also, as Scott mentioned, is the shall means may. Is it shall mean may in Duval County only to the exclusion of the other 66 counties? And just as an aside, I tell my friends that we're soliciting money to put up a billboard on I-95 southbound when you leave the airport, and it says, welcome to Jacksonville, where shall means may. Do whatever you want. Mike Williams, sheriff. My lawyer's Jason Gabriel, too. So not to make light of it, but those are some of the issues we're going to have to deal with.
Sure. Okay, and let me ask one more question before we go to all of the callers. The school board and the city council and the mayor are at odds over the funding formula here for improving all of these local public schools. Supporters of funds for charter schools want a carve-out that critics have said is quite hefty, a per-pupil formula rather than a square-footage formula for how tax money is assessed to pay for these school improvements. Audrey Moran, this really, it boils down to whether you fall on the side of funding for traditional public schools or you fall on the educational divide of wanting to see more of this money funneled toward charter schools, including ones that have yet to be built in Duval County. And so how will the charter debate come up in this legal strategy?
From our perspective, it will come up as a part of the discussion as voters decide how they are going to vote on this issue. Again, our work is to get it to the ballot. And there will be lots of public discussion once that happens about the formula for funding as it relates to charter schools. That is not part of the legal issue that we're facing. What we're facing is the roadblock to getting it to the voters, and we intend to get that roadblock removed and get it to the voters.
And how will you do that? Which judge will hear this? When will you be filing something? You know, what's the next move? Can you share any news there?
I think the short answer to that is no, we won't share that. Okay. We're still working through lots of issues, we'll be happy to come back on and tell you that once we know.
All right. Let's go to some calls now for Hank Cox, Audrey Moran, and Scott Cairns, the legal dream team, as they've been called, representing the Duval County Public Schools in the school officials' push to get a half-cent sales tax referendum before the county's voters. This is to repair and improve aging school buildings across Duval, some of the oldest school buildings in the state. Where do you stand? What are your questions? It's 549-2937. Susan is in Mandarin. Hi, Susan. Good morning.
I understand they can't talk about the case, but I wonder if they could just answer a quick question. Is there any chance we can vote on it in 2019 so that the repairs can begin in 2020? And if part of the issue would be the cost to Mike Hogan, would the city council be required to pay any extra costs because they delayed? And if I could just please ask one more question is, do you think the general counsel should be appointed by a joint committee of the city council and the school board rather than the mayor? It seems like the mayor's office is exercising undue influence, and maybe the Charter Revision Commission should change the who hires and fires the general counsel. Thank you for being on the show. I love this show.
Oh, thank you, Susan. Thank you for that. Okay, so a couple of questions there. One about the timeline, when this could conceivably get on the ballot, and then the other question, should the city revisit the way the Office of General Counsel is appointed, given that there's been some criticism that Mr. Gabriel is, critics say, executing the mayor's agenda rather than acting as an independent city attorney. What are your thoughts?
Melissa, on the first question, I think at the time this resolution was initially presented, there was plenty of time for this to get on the ballot in 2019. I think that the time window for November of 2019 is closed. I think we still have the opportunity for a mail-in ballot for 2019. One of the things that impacts this is if we get to January 2nd, I think it is, of 2020, then a new state law requires that there not be a special election. And so at that point, we would really be limited to November of 2020.
Isn't that why the school board wanted to get this on the ballot this year? Because they saw a window closing?
Yes, and let me just say, Warren Jones, whom I talked to as recently as yesterday.
On the school board, former city councilman.
Reminded me that the cost of sheer maintenance for dilapidated schools, for lack of a better term, broken down things, is $500,000 a month. So that's all that money being spent while this issue is just being thrown around, not resolved, and everything else. Rather than, as some people say, get it on the ballot. If the voters approve it, let's reduce the cost and get these places fixed.
And the caller's right. There is urgency to this issue. There are children in school without air conditioning. There are children in school without drywall. There are children who are in conditions that cannot learn in. And so this isn't something that's a little extra for kids. This is basic necessities, and so there is a sense of urgency around it.
Let's also point out that Clay County is undergoing a similar fight. Its school board and its commission are at odds over a very similar issue. Will that play at all into your case?
Well, the decision that came out of Clay County, I think, will the analysis will play into it, because that court decided that while there was discretion with respect to the timing of placing it on the ballot, that shall meant shall with respect to whether the city council put it on the ballot or not. And we agree with that analysis.
The judge ruled the Clay County Commission can decide when it goes on the ballot, but they can't prevent it from going on the ballot, essentially, right?
Yes, and that they also cannot unreasonably delay in putting it on the ballot.
Okay. Do you feel that the city officials at Jacksonville City Council are putting up unreasonable delays? Are creating unreasonable delays?
All I'm going to say is once it became shall means may, the party started. I mean, this, how you get from that point to here probably is why it started that way. I don't know. You mentioned something earlier, Melissa, and that was one proposal about allocation dollars per pupil versus square footage. And we've heard that, and that's for the voters to decide whether to approve the plan. Our argument had been, and I think the school board's argument was, and the meetings that we had, that Scott and I had with Jason Gabriel and his staff, and subsequent meeting that I had with another lawyer and the council president, and Jason Gabriel and John Phillips, was this ministerial function that the city council has. You put it on the ballot. You have the discretion within reason to set the date, but your obligation is to put it on the ballot. You don't get to nitpick with the terms of the plan. And then, to me, this whole idea, well, it should be dollars per pupil. If Fletcher High School has 500 students, just hypothetically, and Fletcher High School is in good shape, but Raines is not in good shape, and they have 500 students, and they are in desperate need of help, why would you allocate the dollars per pupil? Why don't you allocate the dollars where the need is greatest to repair the schools? And so that's why I think, you know, when the city council gets, well, I think it ought to be dollars per pupil. And our position was, that's not their function. They're not a super school board. School board's responsibilities are clear, and so is the city council.
There's a tweet about that from a listener. I would love for this group to comment on how unprecedented the city council and mayor's obstruction has been. Most districts with referendums don't share anything with charters, and none of them had to have a plan with every detail and a timeline before they got the referendum. Your thoughts, Audrey?
Well, we have a situation where we have a elected school board, and they have put forth a case for need for a sales tax, a sales surtax. We are in a situation where the city council has refused to perform their ministerial duty of placing it on the ballot, period. That is unprecedented. And the fact that one elected body is putting up a roadblock to a second elected body is very, very unfortunate. And that's why we're in this case, because we believe the law provides for the city council to do its job, place it on the ballot, and then for the Duval County School Board, an elected school board, to present a plan well thought out to the voters for their review. For the city council to micromanage that process is really going above and beyond their authority.
Let's go to Tom on the West Side. Hello, Tom. You're on the air. Good morning.
Ah, good morning to y'all. And thank you for all that you're doing this morning. Appreciate it. I really don't think the sales tax is the best thing we can do. But unfortunately, with the intransigence we're seeing from the city council, I think it may be the only thing we can do to improve the plight of our children. At the city council meeting, I heard council member after council member say there was time to get this right. But we are putting our children's future on hold, and that's something that's just unconscionable. We need to put the money into their education and let them progress as best as they can. Also, a quick aside here, even if shall does make may, I don't know if this is legally applicable, but may, make also has a questionable definition, because if you say answer a question with you may not, then it's a declarative statement, just as if you'd said shall.
So, all right, thanks, Tom. Knows? Okay, thank you for that. Here's a tweet from Stephen. I'd like to know the attorney's take on city council members publicly stating they thought the vote would fail.
Can you be a little more specific? Which vote?
Well, the referendum itself going before the voters, some city council members said, well, it might fail anyway. So why should we approve this?
Well, I don't know which council member may have said that. I'll just make the observation. If that's how the council member sees their responsibility in this process, that's a disappointment. Because this whole issue is the public's right to make the decision on this half cent.
Let me ask you about a couple of other things that have cropped up with this, and we'll go to a few more callers. At the city council meeting where this measure was withdrawn, controversially, the council president threw the public out of the meeting. I would like to get your thoughts on that, and also a recent push to make the superintendent an elected official. So not only is there a controversy over this referendum, there was controversy over the public not being given access to the public proceedings. There's been talk and even a bill filed by a state legislator, Jason Fisher, to have an appointed rather than an elected school board and have an elected rather than an appointed superintendent. So it's kind of almost dizzying, all of these things that are happening. Yeah. But I care to weigh in on any of these other aspects of this fight.
Yeah, let me weigh in on the city council meeting. Council President Wilson is a good man. He is ordinarily a very solid, level-headed leader. And I like him personally. I think if we had it to do all over again, perhaps it would come out differently. The people are very frustrated with what is happening. Citizens in Jacksonville are extremely frustrated as to what they perceive as backroom deals with powerful people and the average citizen being left out of the discussion. And unfortunately, that city council meeting became sort of a metaphor for that when everyone was thrown out of the room. Council president has a duty to keep decorum and to keep civility and control in the council chambers so all can be heard. And evidently he made the call that could no longer continue, and that's why he cleared the chambers. I was not there that evening, but I do know that it is much better politics. It is much better policy when people can be part of the process, when the process can be as transparent as possible, and when the average citizen can have the right to be heard and hear what is happening in their local government.
Scott Cairns.
Well, on the issue of the elected superintendent, I have to say that it does seem to go back and forth on a daily basis of what's before the council and the voters. But with respect to elected superintendent, I think that across the state, the larger school districts all have appointed superintendents, because running a large school district is the job for a professional, not for a politician. And much of that goes back. The decision on whether to do that, I think, goes back to the Constitution of Florida, which says in Article 9, and this really underlies a lot of our discussions, that in Article 9 of the Florida Constitution, it says that the school board shall operate, control, and supervise all free public schools within the school district and play a role in determining taxes. So I think that we're really dealing with a core constitutional issue of who's running this, the public schools that are within Duval County.
People that have followed this closely, some have observed that Duval County is ground zero right now in the fight over public education and charter schools in the state of Florida. Do you agree? Do you see yourselves as joining a much larger fight?
Let me make one observation. When I served on the Constitution Revision Commission, Florida Constitution Revision Commission, which ended just before the last general election, charter schools were a big issue. And there were proposals from everywhere. And it was the only issue struck by the Florida Supreme Court as misleading to the public in the language it had. But I will say, if you look at the local situation, Gary Chartrand, I consider a longtime friend. And Gary Chartrand was my resource when I was on the Constitution Revision Commission when charter school
former
issues came up.
Former head of the State Board of Ed, a proponent of charter schools. Yeah.
And I'd call Gary. I'd say, Gary, here's the issue. Here's what we're debating. Here's what we may vote on today. And I would take a lot of guidance from Gary. Well, Gary's a name you hear now in this whole issue. He is almost, I think, the point person we hear about, whether it's true or not, with respect to charter schools. That's all well and good, but that's not the issue we're dealing with. We're dealing with one simple issue, which is, does the school board have a right to put this proposal on the ballot for the citizens to decide the conditions of these schools, not for little other people involved? Money can be changed. They can always deal with changes in the allocation of money.
Okay, 549-2937. Daryl is in St. Augustine. Hi, Daryl. Thanks for holding. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you. Great show, Melissa.
Thanks.
Just an FYI for the residents of Duval, please don't fix your education system up there. It has been a massive economic boom for northern St. John's County. We have turned those paper farms, those pine trees there, into hundreds of millions of dollars of real estate. The people live there. They go to Duval County for jobs. They bring the money back to us. And they dump it in St. John's County. So please don't fix it.
Little irony from you, Daryl.
you keep uneducating your kids. Keep your kids stupid, and we will just love this economic boom. I did hear a while back, a couple of weeks ago, when you were talking to one of the commissioners, and he was saying he had questions. The only question he should have is, how fast can we be like St. John's County? It is really stunning how greedy they are trying to turn your public schools and abuse your public schools for their effort to take your tax dollars and send them friends in their charter.
All right, Daryl, thanks. And we caught your drift there, making a little joke about the fact that it is a serious issue, honestly, that a lot of the dollars are flowing to St. John's County. What about that?
Well, and they've seen, St. John's County has seen the benefit that comes from when you invest in a high quality public education system. You know, the economic development issues here are very, very interesting. We know that when companies look at Jacksonville, Florida to relocate or to build a company here in our county, the first question they ask is about our public school system. The very first. We are in a position now where we can invest in our public school system, make it stronger, make it better, and make it a point of pride for this county and follow the law. And the benefits that will come from that are exemplified by what this last caller talked about in St. John's County. People want a strong public education system for their children.
And Clay County.
And Clay County as
yes.
well. All right. So one last question. I'll try one more time. Where does this go from here? What's your next move? Any tidbit at all, we will gladly take. So what's next?
Scott, you're on.
No tidbits.
But whatever, spoken like a lawyer.
Whatever tidbits there are will be sooner than later.
Okay. Well, thank you, Hank Cox, Scott Cairns, and Audrey Moran for joining us. We really appreciate your time today. Thanks for being
here. Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Still to come, It's our book club on the show. We review a classic tale of Jim Crow America, Passing by Nella Larsen. We'll be right back.
Some of them are worthless. Some have infinite value. And some, you'll never know how much they are worth until you have to cash them in. On the next Snap Judgment from WNYC, we proudly present The Promise. Snap Judgment, storytelling with a beat. Do not miss it.
Saturday afternoon at 2 on 89.9 WJCT. Lindsay Kilbride, host of WJCT's podcast, What It's Like. It starts with some of the best conversations recorded in Jacksonville by StoryCorps.
I remember being on the school bus and passing by and seeing you outside. You were under the addiction at the time.
And then I go deeper into the story.
How do you cope with the guilt you still feel? How do you cope with that?
Subscribe to What It's Like from WJCT wherever you get your podcasts.
Christina, what's on the front page of today's Times Union?
At the top of the page, Florida lawmakers may...
Around the country, volunteers are reading local newspapers to people with vision loss or print disabilities. Did you know WJCT has this service? On a special radio we provide, you'll get the Florida Times Union every day. Learn more at wjct.org/radio reading. With help from sponsors like Florida Eye Specialists, radio reading gives voice to the printed word.
Hi, I'm Damian Lamar. Join me for Taste Test and broaden your musical palate as we redefine urban radio. Have a taste, tonight at 11 on WJCT 89.9 FM. Your community, your world, your music.
This book club segment is underwritten by San Marco Books and More.
Welcome back. It's a classic story dealing with the intersection of race, class, and culture. And it's a window into post-World War I Jim Crow America, when people of color would try to pass as white. Passing by Nella Larsen is this month's pick on the book club. Our brilliant leader, Stacey Goldring, is here to explain why. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks. Thanks for being here. This is a much-loved book. Let's begin by explaining, what does passing mean?
Well, the book has many layered meanings, but on the superficial level, it's a book about African women in the 1920s, two friends. They both choose to pass, but differently. So they're light-skinned, they're in Chicago, and they one passes for convenience, and the other passes when it suits her, okay? And the book explores what happens when you make those choices. Mm-hmm. So it's a book about friendship. It's a book about loss of innocence. It's a book about the repercussions of leaving your past behind. So ultimately, it's a book about identity as well. It's mm-hmm. a thin book, but it's incredibly, incredibly powerful. And passing can also refer to the passing over from that transition between life and death. I did some research, and Henry Louis Gates Jr. talks about the importance of this in the book, and I won't tell you why. But it also, if you don't mind me rambling here, it's about female identity as well. If you are a woman in America in the 1920s, you don't have the rights that you would have today or the opportunities. But if you're an African-American woman in the 1920s in America, it's a whole different ballgame.
Yeah. That's the tragedy of it. In order to gain any foothold into the opportunity ladder when you attempted to pass as white. You were denying your identity, denying your family.
Mm-hmm. Denying your past.
Denying your past.
Right.
That's the tragedy, the pain of this.
Right. And our author makes us look at the price you pay when you give up your community for relationships, for friendships, and for marriage. And ultimately, communities survived. Relationships may not. Friendships come and go. Marriages, unfortunately, come and go. But communities last. So you have to, you know, titrate those two choices. And we see the deadly things that can happen if you don't make the right choices. You know, female identity, you didn't have a lot of choices. And for our two main characters, Irene and Claire, they have to decide if they want to be financially successful. How do you do that? You marry well. So one of our characters marries a doctor, an intelligent man named Brian, who works, he's African-American and he works in Chicago, but he'd rather be working in Brazil for many reasons. And she doesn't want to give up her life in Chicago. She's become a society woman. She's a philanthropist. She's able to help her community and give back. And the last thing she wants to do is take her two young boys and travel down to some banana republic and start all over again with her husband in the forest, helping people. No, she's worked very hard at this. She has her friend who passes as white permanently, not only marries a Caucasian, but her husband is a racist. The nickname Claire's husband gives to her is Nig.
Oh, wow. So this explains some of the controversy that arose
right.
when this book was published.
Well, yeah, because here we are in the mind. It's very stream of conscience. And we are in the mind of a woman. So Irene is telling us the story. And we're getting it through her, what's happening between her and Claire. And what we're finding out is that it is... It's an internal struggle. And you know what? The Harlem Renaissance, the literati, they didn't like it. Why didn't they like it? Okay, well, I may get some, you know, backlash for this, but I'm no newcomer to that. It was mostly men. And the men really didn't want books out about women who are, you know, high society women who are worried about their friends and their marriages and, you know, their financial standing. And that's serious stuff that's survival. And today we can read this book through that lens and understand it, which is why I'm so grateful that this is becoming finally recognized for the incredible book that it is.
It is. And it recently reissued. It was first mm-hmm. published in 1929 and right. just got reissued. So mm-hmm. it remains so relevant today, doesn't it?
Oh,
particularly
incredibly.
With the way our political culture is riven by race, class,
identity.
It's still, all of the themes are still current today.
It truly is. And if you have not read anything by Nella Larsen, she has a small body of work. But I challenge you to find this book at a bookstore, at the library, wherever you can, and read it to have a really personal feminine view of what it was like to grow up in America during those times.
During those times.
Yeah.
Now let's shift gears and talk mm-hmm. about another place and time, because there's much excitement at San Marco Books and More when an incredible author, Amor Towles, is going to visit on September 18th to talk about his famous book, A Gentleman in Moscow. You are going to be having an event to promote this at the bookstore. Can you tell us all about it?
Sure. In preparation for Amor Towles' visit to Jacksonville, we'll be discussing A Gentleman in Moscow tonight at San Marco Books and More, starting at 6:30. I would love to have you come out. And you know how it is with me. You never have to read the book to come to a book club.
Uh-huh.
And it will be a very interesting evening. I want to know why this book speaks to you. And I want to know if you, the listeners who have read it, do you consider it an American classic? You know, one of those next rising stars. And if so, why? And if not, why? But Melissa, we have sold over 650 tickets for the event next week.
When he appears at the bookstore.
Yeah. Well, not at the bookstore. We're going to be at the church.
Pardon me. Mm-hmm. Yes, at the nearby church. Mm-hmm. Right. This is another book set about 100 years ago. Another person who's displaced.
Correct.
Another person who's out of place. And so there are some similar themes there. But it gives you a window into what Russia was like in that era.
Right. So we have a despot takeover. We have the Bolshevik Revolution. So we have the Count Rostov, who is, because he writes a poem that's considered, troublesome for the government, he is sentenced to live in the Hotel Metropole in Russia, which really exists. And we get to see life through this micro, kind of like a kaleidoscope of what happens in society over the decades through the people coming and going through the hotel. So the author does a great job of each character, and I stop counting at 47, how they each represent something so important, and it comes together beautifully at the end. So for those of you who like to tie things up with a knot and say, closure, this book is for you.
This book is for you. So come on out to San Marco Books and More tonight to have Stacy lead a discussion of A Gentleman in Moscow. That's tonight at 6:30. And as you said, just a few tickets left for the event on the 18th when the author himself, Amor Towles, is coming to town to do a book signing and talk. And the reason he's coming is because your underwriter for this segment, San Marco Books and More, put a window display in the window that was so incredible to promote the book that it won a contest.
Yeah. Penguin Books selected San Marco Books and More. It was a worldwide pitch to go ahead and create something exciting for the book. And of course, it was coming out in paperback, so it's a brilliant marketing thing too. But nonetheless, it's a fabulous book. And the creation that was made not only has all the elements of this book, but it also has the elements of who the writer is. So a lot of research went into that window. If you take a look at it, go by, get a selfie in front of the window, because you'll be looking at that window forever and unlocking keys not only to the Hotel Metropole, but to what kind of writer Amor is.
Go look at the window display. Go on out to the bookstore tonight. Get a selfie with Stacy because she, too, is a rock star. The best book club leader you will ever know. She'll lead a discussion tonight on A Gentleman in Moscow. Her selection for the month is Passing by Nella Larson. And just a few tickets left for the September 18th event in San Marco with best-selling author Amor Towles. Go to Facebook's the San Marco Books and More Facebook page to get all the information, and I'll see you soon. And thank you so much.
Thank you.
In a moment, author and speaker Jim Knight on creating a company culture that rocks. That's next.
Sometimes what a person does in this economy can tell you something.
When times are good and the consumer has a little bit more money in their pocket, they might opt for a bar or a restaurant experience. In tighter times, the consumer will stop at a store on their way home from work and pick up a six-pack or a 12-pack.
I'm Kai Rizdahl from Barkeeps to Bankers, Life in This Economy, next time on Marketplace.
This evening at 6, here on 89.9 WJCT.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Tim Brown left a career as a soccer player to get a business degree, and 2 years later, he co-founded Allbirds, the eco-conscious shoe company that claims its shoes are the most comfortable you'll ever wear. He used clever social media advertising to quickly grow the company into one now valued at more than $1 billion. He'll join us next time on Here and Now.
This afternoon at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
on the next Fresh Air, breaking the Harvey Weinstein story. We talk with New York Times reporters Jody Kantor and Megan Toohey. In their new book, She Said, they write about their investigation and the people and practices that protected Weinstein. They also reveal new details about what Harvey's brother and business partner, Bob, knew about Harvey's behavior. Join us. Today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
What does a fair deal look like for those who have suffered from the nation's opioid epidemic? States are seeking billions of dollars from Purdue Pharma, the maker of OxyContin, and its owners, the Sackler family. But bankruptcy could make a messy situation messier. Justice and the fight for a family fortune, next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, how do you change a company culture to make it more successful? It's easier said than done. This Thursday, the FSCJ Business Speaker Series presented by First Florida Credit Union is hosting Culture That Rocks, How to Amp Up or Revolutionize a Company's Culture. Now, this is a free event. It's led by best-selling author and former Hard Rock International executive Jim Knight. He is known for his high-energy presentations that business leaders across the nation have checked out. We've got a preview right now. Jim Knight is on the line. Hey, Jim, good morning.
Good morning. How's it going?
I'm great, thanks. Thanks for joining us. So every company wants a culture that rocks, but it's easier said than done. Tell me a little bit about what people will learn at your presentation, because changing company culture is hard.
It is, yeah. I think probably for anybody that's coming in, regardless if they're an employee or they're a business leader, or quite honestly, just anybody in the public, I think they're going to get some real-world practical takeaways to help amp up the culture. And I think to your point, it's hard. People aren't exactly sure what the heck culture is in the first place. But if I'm coming through and I'm a business leader, I totally get how important it is. And they're going to figure out during that time how to transform their culture, regardless of the current state. And if you're an employee, you're really going to understand how you do contribute to a company's identity. So there's a little bit for everybody, but it is going to be replete with a lot of meaty takeaways, no doubt.
Okay, and you have three key ways you say a company can revolutionize its culture. What are those three ways?
Yeah, I'm actually going to share 10 in the session.
10, okay.
I would say if I had to pick my top three, I do. Yeah, there's going to be some really, really great stuff, and I'll be moving at blazing speed. But for your audience, Melissa, I'll make sure that I give you the sort of top three, if you will. And first and foremost, I'm going to hang my hat on the people. So I know you have to surround yourself with the best talent. So one of those takeaways is absolutely going to have to be only rock stars can amp up the band. And I think anybody in the audience probably knows that. And I'm going to talk about where do you find these people and how do you go get them and love on them and inspire them and motivate them. But you got to surround yourself with awesome people, number one. I'd say right behind that, you got to make sure that everybody is singing off the same sheet of music. So that's about enhancing your communication. And again, I'll be moving fairly quickly, but I'm going to give them as many things as I can around communication so that they can crank that up, even if they think they're pretty good at that right now. And probably the last thing I would say is, you know, even though we're talking about culture, I can't in good conscience talk about it without at least bringing up the service aspect. So if you've got some authentic customer obsession, you do that right, you will create lifelong raving fans and ultimately getting them to come back, spend more, and talk about you positively. So if I had to pick three out of the 10, those are the three.
Those are good ones. And you'll also explain to some of the executives there how you can measure the effects of an improved culture. How do you do that?
Yeah, I think first off, you know, business owners, they sort of for a long time were probably not coveting the brand strong culture in the first place. You know, it was sort of a throwaway for so long. And I think now there's a reason why we constantly are talking about brands who get it, like Chick-fil-A and Zappa's, Southwest and Publix and all these great brands. It's because they're awesome. And I think I've now figured out that when you start to climb underneath the grill and you see from an external or an internal standpoint, if you just look at the business metrics, let's just take internally. If you know that if you're absolutely focusing on the employee and morale is going to be higher, turnover is going to be lower, that actually means something. And I know there's a direct correlation between turnover and ultimately top line sales. And when you start talking numbers like that, the physical metrics that can make the business rock, that's when business owners start to perk up a little bit more. So, you know, I am going to share some things on how to actually go out there and measure it. But at the end of the day, if they just did a little bit of a case study around the Starbucks and the Hard Rocks and the Disneys of the world, they'll get it. They'll understand that they're not just going after the end user, the customer. They're going below the surface of the iceberg. They're hanging out, focusing on the employees. You get that right, it's the service profit chain all over again. Things are going to be fantastic.
And this is certainly more important than ever. A new survey out by Glassdoor this summer found that most adults say they value a company's culture even above salary in regard to their job satisfaction. Yep. A majority of employees and job seekers say company culture is one of the main reasons they would stay at a job. That is so true. If you like the place you're working at, even if the salary isn't exactly what you want, you'll stay longer. Something hiring managers know, and I know you know, Jim, so people need to come out and see Gym Night. This is going to be a great event. It's part of the FSCJ Business Speakers Series, Culture That Rocks, How to Amp Up or Revolutionize a Company Culture. This is free. It's coming up this Thursday, 8:30 a.m. at the Wilson Center for the Arts at FSCJ South on Beach Boulevard. Best-selling author and nationally renowned speaker Jim Knight giving the keynote. So, Jim, thanks so much for sharing a preview with us. We appreciate it.
You got it. You got it. Today's the last day to RSVP. Jump on it. I look forward to seeing everybody there. Rock on, Melissa.
You too. Rock on. Thanks for that. We are going to rock on out now. Thanks for listening. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Michelle Corum is our director. If you want to comment about the culture of WJCT and what you hear on the air, you can email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tomorrow, a conversation with State Attorney Melissa Nelson about criminal justice reform in Florida. That's tomorrow. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. If you're listening to our rebroadcast tonight, just keep listening for some great music. We'll see you tomorrow.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.